And turn things over to Jim Rice from ICF, who will be the session facilitator. So, Jim, whenever you're ready, please begin.
All right. Well, thank you, Jean, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Boy, it looks like we have a pretty good crowd from across the country, and I believe we even have a few international participants. So we also have a really great group of speakers for today, who I'll introduce in just a few minutes. But first, I want to say a few words about the webinar series. So EPA's Office of Research and Development designed this series of webinars to explore several key aspects of working with contaminated sediment sites. You can see the topic areas that we're covering on the screen. For those of you who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform the agency decisions. Now, their research is really directed by the needs of their partners and their stakeholders. So the objective of these seminars is both to inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about some of the latest tools and methodologies that are available, but also, just as important, is to solicit your concerns and research needs about some of the topic areas that we'll be talking about. These webinars are designed to be interactive and generate discussion, just like you would at a technical conference. So, to get you warmed up, we pose a question for you. You'll see questions like this throughout the session. To get you warmed up, we'd like you to respond to the questions that you've seen already and respond to this question that we have. Looks like we have a number of different respondents. So there's a lot of challenges working with contaminated sediments. As we can see by some of the responses that we had in our previous session, as well as this session, related specifically to challenges with risk assessments. As you can see, we have a lot of really challenging issues. Sediment sites can be very large, diffuse areas that are difficult to control with multiple sources. They're often dynamic conditions. Somebody mentioned ephemeral streams in one of their comments. And there are some really unique resources that are contained in the surface water and sediment ecosystem that we have to really address during all of the phases of site investigation and cleaning up. And oftentimes, these sites challenge us with much higher remediation costs when we think about the traditional methods that are used for remediation. So to address these challenges, we really need to find more effective ways to address the sediments throughout the project life cycle. Our CSMs really have to be robust and based on strong framework of characterization and risk assessment. We have to use relevant toxicological information to inform these risk assessments and develop good cleanup goals and effective remedial actions that take into account the characterization and risk data. And ultimately, once we've got a remedial action, we need to be able to efficiently monitor and measure the remedy effectiveness and ensure that we've optimized the system. So, over the next several weeks, this series of talks will bring together experts exploring the latest thinking in all of these areas. Especially today, we're focused on risk assessment. And your job is to listen, digest, and respond to that information and give us your feedback. So today's risk assessment topic will include three different speakers. Our first presentation is from Ned Black, who will discuss the use of toxicity bioassays in CERCLA risk assessments, and he'll show us several examples from the West Coast. Dr. Black is a regional ecologist for EPA Region 9, and he has experience across a wide range of ecosystems, everything from reefs to high-altitude forests. Next, Lawrence Burkhart will discuss the methods and models used to evaluate bioaccumulation of organic chemicals in fish. Dr. Burkhart is a research chemist with EPA's ORD in Minnesota, and he specializes in bioconcentration and bioaccumulation of organic contaminants by benthic invertebrates and fish, and he does food web modeling. Now, our final speaker for this afternoon is Sharon Toms, and she's an ecological risk assessor with EPA Region 4 in Atlanta. Her expertise is in screening benchmarks for ecological risk assessment, and she'll talk about a number of different types of benchmarks that are used to assess toxicity of contaminated sediments. And she's going to present some pretty interesting information on the performance of these benchmarks. So, we encourage you to actively participate in the discussions and respond to the various poll questions that will be posed throughout the session. So now I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speaker, Ned Black from EPA Region 9. Ned.
Thank you, Jim. So waiting for my slides to pop up, but while they're coming up, here we go. As the leadoff batter today, I want to start by giving a broad but brief overview of ecological risk assessment as we use it to set cleanup goals. This is particularly for the benefit of those of you who checked limited or no experience to set some of the questions that we put up there. And I'm going to be talking about examples where we used toxicity bioassays at contaminated sediment sites, at least in an attempt to set cleanup goals. The examples that I chose were not the most simple or straightforward that I could have, but I felt that having a little bit of confusion in data interpretation actually gives us a better learning opportunity. But that's why my full title is Toxicity Bioassays, a Useful Line of Evidence in Ecological Risk Assessments, if you know what you're doing. So this is the Superfund or the CERCLA risk assessment model expressed as a Venn diagram. And the important point, or one important point here, is that, let's see, where's my green pointer? I don't see it yet. In any case, there it is. Perfect. Come back. Thank you. What we're looking for is the overlap, either in our conceptually in our data or actually on our landscape or sedimentscape, of the presence of contaminants of concern and receptors that might be harmed by those contaminants of concern. And within ecological risk assessment, those receptors range from plants to worms to fish to bugs and bunnies. But simply having both of those together is not enough actually to say that you've completed your risk characterization, your risk assessment. You also need some evidence of effects of the contaminants on the receptors. So for instance, if all you have is the presence of contaminants and receptors, but you're essentially in this zone here where you either can't demonstrate any evidence of effects on your receptors, or perhaps you might even be able to demonstrate that there is no effect, that zone is what we call acceptable ecological risk. Whereas if you're down in this zone here, where you have all three, the presence of contaminants, ecological receptors, and some evidence of effects, that zone is called unacceptable ecological risk, and that's what gets forwarded from the remedial investigation to the feasibility study for evaluation by the 9 criteria and eventual remedy selection. Now, to place that Venn diagram within the standard flowchart of ecological risk assessment as presented in EPA guidance, what we're talking about today here, all three of us are going to be mostly discussing issues that fall within this box. Some of the other boxes have been dealt with either in the previous session one of this series, or will be dealt with in sessions 3 and 4. But clearly what we're trying to do is collect in data that allow us to ultimately characterize the risk, communicate that risk on to the risk managers who ideally will do something about it. Here's my summary up front of everything that I'd like to get across this morning. So first of all, I want to mention that my examples again are instances where we use toxicity bioassays, and those are simply lab or field experiments to test if a substance is poisonous or toxic, and in particular at what dose or concentration that substance becomes toxic. Now, that substance can be a pure chemical that you simply take out of a bottle on the shelf in your lab and expose it, some organisms to it, or that substance can be contaminated media that you collected from your site. And in particular, today what we're talking about is contaminated sediments that would have been collected for evaluation from some site. There are many organisms and protocols that are used to conduct toxicity bioassays, far too many for me to describe in a few minutes, so I'm going to concentrate on ones that are used in the majority of contaminated sediment sites, which is tox bioassays that use small aquatic invertebrates. There we go, small aquatic invertebrates, such as amphipods like Hylella. And the reason that these are dominate the data collection efforts at contaminated sediment sites is that small aquatic invertebrates are easy to grow and study in the lab, and then from an ecological perspective, they are at or near the base of many food chains. Now, key point to remember, and this will come up in my examples, is that the Superfund or the circular risk model absolutely requires that there be a correlation of contaminant concentrations with the degree of toxicity that you measure in your bioassays. If you cannot achieve that, you can't use the tox bioassays to set cleanup goals. Another important point is that whenever you're doing tox bioassays, you're likely to run into confounding factors that make that interpretation of the data difficult. And I'm going to show you some examples of that, but confounding factors can arise from the media that you're sampling, or how you had to collect your samples, how you transport them, and of course, how you run your studies. My first example is the former McClellan Air Force Base, which is a closed Air Force Base in California, north of Sacramento, in a prairie habitat. Important points to know about the conceptual site model is that to the east of the base, there's a mountain range, and streams flow down out of that mountain range, for instance, Don Julio Creek and Magpie Creek. Immediately before flowing onto the base, they flowed through a light commercial district, commercial and residential district. Then those streams flowed onto the base, and this is now a photograph of that same area. So the runways that you see here are right here in the middle of the map. But in any case, so the streams flowed through the maintenance and industrial areas of the base, where they picked up a number of contaminants. They were in tunnels under the runways, and then they emerged on the west side of the runways in a nature area, which is still being maintained as an open nature area because it is the blast arc around the munitions bunkers. So when this was an Air Force base, the bombs were kept in a series of bunkers right here. After the base closed, that facility was purchased by a fireworks manufacturer, so there are still bombs being stored in these bunkers, and there's still a need to maintain an open blast arc around that. So what that resulted is we did, when it was an air base, and now when it's a commercial facility, there's a large area where the streams, after they've come under the runways, resurface and flow through this open prairie habitat as perennial streams that are now in large part accessible to the public. And there are seasonal wetlands in the area, and also permanent wetlands that have been contaminated by the maintenance activities of the airfield activities. And so what we discovered was there were a lot of contaminated sediments in these streams. The contaminants included things like PCBs and dioxins, metals, pesticides, solvents, petroleum, hydrocarbons. And when we went out and took samples from various locations in the stream beds and took those samples into the lab where we ran amphipod bioassays using Hylella, we got data like this. So here you can see our couple of our control sets of control replicates, and by comparison, one there and one up here, by comparison, some of our sample locations in Magpie and Don Julio Creek showed no increased toxicity compared to the controls, whereas many other sites showed a fair bit of toxicity, ranging from moderate toxicity compared to the controls all the way down to complete toxicity where everything died. And when we first got this data back, it was quite interesting. We were really thrilled to see it. But unfortunately, we were not able to use it to identify toxicity drivers and go on and come up with cleanup goals based on the toxicity bioassays. And the reasons for that were that although all of the toxic locations that we sampled had elevated concentration of some contaminants, there were two main problems, well, three. The lesser problem was that the contaminants were also present at some of the non-toxic locations. Most importantly, however, no contaminant or group of contaminants with a similar toxic mode of action correlated with the toxicity gradient that we saw. So we failed the absolute requirement under Superfund that there be a correlation between our concentration gradient and our toxicity gradient. It was also the case, as a further confounding factor, that sediment samples from locations upstream of McClellan, but in that light commercial district, had some of the same contaminants, although at lower levels. So the upshot at McClellan was, although we did do a series of removal and cleanup actions in the stream nature area, those were based solely on some things that you're going to be hearing about from my follow-on speakers, Lawrence and Sharon, where we compared the sediment concentrations to toxicity benchmarks, in particular for highly bioaccumulative contaminants, where we modeled the concentrations up through the food chain from crayfish to, for ecological risk, to herons, and for human health risk to humans. So there's an example of what looked like some really great data, but ultimately it was unfortunately not usable in the big picture. I want to contrast that and turn to my second example, which was work I did on the Bolsa Chica Wetlands Restoration Project. Bolsa Chica was an oil field south of Los Angeles, right along the Pacific coast, and it was in the process of being shut down, and as that process was going on, the state of California purchased the Bolsa Chica, which was an approximately 600-acre area. You can see it here in this upper photo, which is what it looked like at the start of our project. It had extensive areas that were dry year-round, that were just sort of a coastal scrub habitat, and other areas that had ponds that were either seasonal or permanent, and of course all of this oil field infrastructure scattered throughout. The plan was and the plan that was carried out is that all of the oil field infrastructure was removed, the wells were abandoned and destroyed, And then we came in and, well, simultaneously as the infrastructure was being removed, we came in and started to do a risk assessment to make this into a habitat that was ultimately going to become tidal and subtidal wildlife habitat with open exposure to the ocean. So essentially, after all this infrastructure was removed and we did our risk assessment, we came up with cleanup goals. And then after the cleanup was done, we dug a channel under the Pacific Coast Highway and let the ocean back in because a lot of this area was already at or just below sea level. And it turned into what is now a very successful wildlife refuge, in particular for nesting waterfowl. Our challenge at the start of doing the risk assessment was, again, we were dealing with approximately half the site was terrestrial, was dry dirt, and half the site was seasonal or permanent ponds. And then another challenge was some locations in the site had salinity that was equivalent to what you would expect to see in marine sediments, but a lot of the site did not have that level of salinity in either the soil or the sediments. So we were faced with the issue of taking, in some instances, dry dirt that was not salty and evaluating it as if it was going to become marine sediment so that we could come up with cleanup goals that would be protective of marine receptors. The contaminants were, in large part, the same ones that we saw up at McClellan. But there were polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. There were various fractions of petroleum hydrocarbons. Metals, including a lot of from sandblasting of the equipment, PCBs from the electrical works for the pumps and pesticides that have been used to control rodents. And again, our goal was to set cleanup goals for marine sediments. So we sampled extensively throughout the Bolsa Chica, and what you see here is low molecular weight PAHs presented on the x-axis on a log scale in our samples, and on the y-axis, we took those samples and used them to conduct toxicity bioassays using a marine amphipod. And so on the y-axis, you see survival of the marine amphipods. And I'll point out again, so our samples fell into four categories, defined by whether or not they were dry or wet to start with when we sampled them, and whether they required salinity adjustment to be viewed as marine or did not require salinity adjustment. So in the case here of looking at low molecular weight polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, what you see is that the data itself fell into two broad groups that we were thrilled to see this. We either had samples with lower concentrations of PAHs and high survival of the amphipods, or we had samples with much higher concentrations of the PAHs and low survival of the amphipods, so high toxicity. So this was a pretty clear and simple step function. It didn't seem to matter in this instance what we'd done to the samples. And we were able to use this data very directly to develop our cleanup goals. Ultimately, we were able to put all of the hydrocarbons under the umbrella of TPH. But I want to contrast these results with my last example. Where we're looking at, again, this is for the Bolsa Chica cleanup. What you have here are arsenic concentrations, again, on the x-axis in the log scale from samples taken throughout the Bolsa Chica. And again, marine amphipod toxicity on the y-axis. And this is the sort of data that I'm much more used to seeing when I look at a risk assessment for a marine sediment site. It's noisy. There is, inarguably, there is a trend in the data that as arsenic concentrations increase, toxicity increases or survival decreases. Correlation is pretty poor. However, when we dug into this a little deeper, and today we're just going to do it visually, when we were actually doing these studies, we did it statistically. But when we dug in deeper and started to look at the confounding factors that we ourselves had introduced in evaluating our samples, we discovered that the samples that had the fewest confounding factors, which were wet to start with and which did not require salinity adjustment, actually gave us the best toxicity results. And that's my signal to say that ultimately we were able to use this data simply to solve one final issue. The background arsenic level in this in the Bolsa Chica was around 10, and so we came down to an argument as to whether or not we would set the cleanup goal at the background or we would use our tox data to set a somewhat higher cleanup goal, which we ultimately did, which then resulted in a cheaper cleanup. So with that, I am going to stop and take questions if we still have time, and then I'm going to look forward to hearing from Lawrence and Sharon. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Ned. That was pretty interesting. Some great results there that I think we want to talk about in just a little while, but I'd like to try to stay on schedule here. We'll have plenty of time at the end to address some questions. We do have a couple of questions from the audience, and folks, please feel free to type in your questions. We'll have some time at the end for Ned and the other speakers to answer them. So let's go ahead and move on to Lawrence Burkhart. And Lawrence, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Do I sound okay?
That sounds great. Yeah, let's get started then.
Yes, I was asked to talk about bioaccumulation assessment, how you predict residues, and I'm going to talk today only about organic chemicals. Of course, mercury and metals and other things do bioaccumulate, but can't talk about everything in one little short presentation. So I thought I'd just kind of ask this question to everyone. I don't see the boxes here. How many of you have sites where you're worrying about residues in fish? And I suspect it's pretty common. Yeah, 81, 82, 83. So it is, as I know, and as everyone on the call here apparently knows, that residues in fish are causal driver remedial risks. If I go on, residues in fish are both a function of the concentration of the chemical in the sediment and in the water. And here I have on this slide shown the uptake routes and loss routes for chemicals. And fish will take up chemicals via its gills, that's K1, the great constant for that, or from food. And it will lose chemical via out the depuration via its gills, via its feces. It can, if it biotransforms, it'll lose the chemical. And if the organism grows, essentially the concentration dilutes in the fish, and that is considered a loss mechanism. If you put this fish into a real food web, and I just made this real simple food web here, just to show that this fish has a whole bunch of routes of where a chemical can get to it via the food chain or from the water column or from the sediments. We'll come back to this later in the 30-minute session. What approaches are available for predicting residues in fish? Well, you can actually use empirical things. You measure a biota sediment accumulation factor or a bioaccumulation factor. Or you can use mechanistic models to predict chemicals in fish. It's important to note that empirical and mechanistic models are compatible with each other and they can be used to support each other at a site. if you look at empirical methods, the expressions for bioaccumulation, this is what you'd actually go measure, is a biota sediment accumulation factor, which is the concentration of the fish over the concentration of the sediment on an organic carbon basis, or on a water basis, the BAF, you measure the concentration of fish on a lipid basis and the free to dissolve concentration in the water column. Clearly, these two things have to be self-consistent if you're measuring a fish in a particular ecosystem. What's nice about empirical data is it incorporates all processes affecting the bioaccumulation at your site. Trophic transfer, metabolism, the differential between what's in the water column, what's in the sediment, the bioavailability, organism growth, all that stuff. And it also includes all the ecosystem-specific parameters and processes going on, existing loadings, fluxes, that kind of thing. Challenges with empirical methods. Predictive power is somewhat dependent on having, I have here in a quote, stable conditions at the site. If you go and change the conditions at the site drastically, things will change in terms of what's going on in the ecosystem, and that will ultimately affect the residues in the fish. Things that you do change if you do remedial actions, sometimes you change the relationship of the concentrations between what's in the sediment and what's in the water column. I express this as a disequilibrium. Obviously, at sites, you try to minimize or eliminate sources of chemical to the site and remove chemical from the site. other things that can make it difficult is if the food web structure changes because you've changed somehow the ecosystem characteristics, or you get a new fish that invades the system. Analytically, it's easy to measure BSAFs. The trick with these is assessing their predictive power can be very difficult. BAFs are much more difficult to measure, partly because the concentrations are low, but they have a lot better predictive power. If you switch to mechanistic models for predicting residues, in essence, all mechanistic models solve this differential equation somehow or other. This is the change in concentration in a fish is a function of, I've lost my green arrow. Thank you. The first term here is the uptake. K1 is the rate constant for uptake from water. Kd here is the uptake from food and fraction of food and prey items. And then you have losses via the gills, losses via growth dilution, losses via biotransformation, and losses via being excreted via the feces. There are models that find the steady-state solution. Essentially, we set the differential to zero, and by the simple rearrangement, we get this equation here that's shown, and we have one of these for each species in the food web. This kind of equation can modeling construct can be simply solved using an Excel spreadsheet. It's not very complicated to do. If you go to dynamic solutions, we actually set up a series of differential equations just like this, one for each species, and then we use numerical integration techniques to find get the concentrations over time. As many of you know, there's a pile of models out there. I've just listed some that kind of came quickly to mind. And when you go to Superfund sites, the ones here with the blue arrows, the QA anchor model, and the Arnott-Gobus model are mostly used at Superfund sites. The Arnott-Gobus is a steady state model, but you do see variations of this. And the anchor model can be run either as a dynamic or steady state formulation. Now, mechanistic models require you to know something. One is ecosystem conditions. Concentration of chemical in water and sediment, temperature, organic carbon in the water, in the water column and the particulates, as well as organic carbon in the sediment. You need to know the structure of the food web, who's eating who and how much. You need to know organism-specific parameters, weights, lipids. You kind of get the gist here. And then you need to know the chemical-specific parameter, the KOW. Challenges in developing mechanistic models, there are some. Often, and I've been to been required to look at a number of different sites. Data is often awfully lacking, especially water data, concentrations in water, because it's difficult to measure. This is becoming somewhat less of a problem with passive sampling, but I've been to many places, oh, we don't need any water data. Well, yes, you do, after you kind of figure things out. There also seems to be never enough really good data for the fish of interest. A lot of times you look at, well, we have one sampling 5 years ago. Well, I can develop a model using one data 5 years ago, but I really need some data over time. The other thing that we're often lacking is data for the underlying species in the food web, forage fish, invertebrates, phytoplankton. Without those, we can set up models and make all kinds of predictions, but without that kind of data, it makes it very difficult to know how well you're doing. There's also complications from poorly stood inputs, and I've just listed two here. Dietary preference, what is the fish of interest eating? And fish do move, and their foraging behavior is different for different times of the year and those kinds of things. For dynamic models, it requires you have time-varying input. So concentrations in the water column and sediment over time need to change. Well, how do you get such data? Well, typically, you run something, a hydrodynamic and a sediment transport model. And I've listed two here, EFDC and Schedule J. You also need to know something about how the environmental conditions are, temperature of the site, how suspended solids, organic carbon, all that stuff is moving around over the time. And then you also have to incorporate biotic behavior. Where does it go? Does it change behavior over the year? That type of thing. One of the challenges and one of the difficulties here, it turns out, and this is true, I'm guilty as much as anybody else, models are highly calibrated to the available data. If you don't have much data, it's calibrated to whatever data you got. This can lead to non-unique calibrations. Where the same where differing inputs and give you the same outputs. So, and kind of give you a sense, what I mean by that is there was a model developed for Lower Duwamish River Superfund site. Excuse me. And this was a probabilistic version of the GOBUS model with 114 individual inputs. And they were did Monte Carlo methods to kind of optimize the parameters for this. But just given that we have 114 individual model inputs, you kind of get back to this non-unique calibration situation. I think some thoughts and cautions are always are good for everyone. Before launching into developing a model, what really spend some time and think about what level of complexity do I need for my site? Will a simple empirical data work be adequate? Do I need a, could I use a simple steady state model? Or do I need a time variant dynamic model? As you go down from simple to dynamic here, the costs and time increase drastically. And depends on your site. And you may be able to make a simple decision saying, well, the residues are way too high. We're going to do something, and the remedial is this. That might be enough. The bottom line here, measure residues in your fish, if that's what's driving your risk, are the truth. And so having good fish data makes things a lot better. One thing I want to caveat and talk about just briefly is that there's a lot of concern and interest about fluorinated substances these days. The models that I was talking about don't apply. They all assume that chemicals behave via passive diffusion within the organism and uptake as well. Fluorinated materials don't behave that way, and there's active transport processes controlling the residues in the fish. And there's a lot of research going on in this right now, but if someone comes to you and say, you've got to have this chemical at your site and we're going to run the RNOT GOBUS model, they're pulling your leg. That's not going to work. So just it's a warning. In the extra 30 minutes that we have at the end of this presentations, I want to kind of maybe kick this off and let you guys we can talk about this. One of the remedial actions that's being talked about and being done somewhat is adding activated carbon to sediments. What processes are affected? What are the effects on the residues in this purple fish? And so we'll talk about this in the extra 30 minutes. So I'm going to open it up now to time for some Q&A on bioaccumulation. Back to you, Jim.
Thanks, Lawrence. So folks, feel free to put your questions in, and we'll bring them up to Lawrence, and he'll answer them. So Lawrence, I had a couple of questions for you while we're waiting for some other questions to come in. You mentioned a couple of times the calibration of these mechanistic models. How does one go about calibrating or checking the calibration of one of these mechanistic models?
Well, you have some site data. And so when I say some site data, you have data for concentrations in water and sediment, and you have concentration in the fish. And you say, well, I'm using these two concentrations in sediment and water, what do I predict for residues in the fish? And I basically compare the predicted residues to the measured residues. And that's what all modelers do. So the more data you have for the fish, the better your calibration can be. Ideally, what would be really good to do is, I have this data from year 2017, and I have now fish data for 2018. I set the model up using the 2017 model data, and then make the predictions for the 2018. Two totally different data sets. And so one to do calibration and one to do the validation. As you can see, more data makes this thing a lot better.
Yeah, it sounds like the data collection aspect is pretty critical. Can you give us some suggestions for what the key data are to collect for water and fish?
Well, for sediment, that's done pretty well these days because of people doing SWACs and things like that. What we're often lacking is concentrations in the water column. And turns out that's a very sensitive parameter, even though you have a lot of chemical in the sediment. That's a very sensitive parameter in terms of what the ultimate residue is in the fish. And we often don't have very much data on that, partly because it's difficult to measure. And I'm hoping with passive sampling, that would we can do a much better job of that. The other thing is that you really need, for fish, data over time. Not just the one single snapshot kind of thing. And if you really want to bracket things well, if you have the money and resources and time to collect species from the collect the dietary items of the fish of interest, so what it's eating. But that is very rare.
So it would be important to collect samples from across that food web that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Interesting. Now, going back to the water quality that you said is often lacking, is it the contaminants of concern, the contaminants, that data that's lacking, or is it more broadly the water quality information that might affect things like nutrients and survivability and such?
It's actually concentration of the contaminant in the water column over time. So if you're talking about PCBs, PCBs, for example, which is a common contaminant at Superfund sites, very rarely do you have concentrations in the water column, period. And so you end up kind of going, well, how am I going to get that?
Right.
One way is One way is to make an estimate of it, and that's what we end up doing without that data.
So one of our questions that just came in is about, you know, how do we collect good representative samples? How do we go about making sure we are collecting the right samples? Is it useful to have someone like a biologist or someone with that level of experience to help us design water sampling locations and methodologies?
I would say, yeah, someone who's knowledgeable about field sampling, yes. And and knowing something about lake systems are different than river systems, then as well as from estuarine systems. And knowing something about how the water is flowing and moving, and being able to set up enough sampling points to kind of cover the system, your site, over time, as well as across the site. It's kind of hard to talk in theory here.
Sure.
But it, clearly, having data makes the world a lot easier, makes models much more predictable.
Lawrence, we had a question come in about the integration of passive diffusion sampling data. Have you been able to integrate the results of passive diffusion samplers for sediment and also for water in your data sets and analyses?
For the data that you get for the water column, that data from passive sampling is the freely dissolved concentration in the water column. And that can be used directly, stuck right into the model. It's a direct input. The freely dissolved concentration in the sediment pore water becomes a little more problematic. When I say problematic, the models are really set up. It would be used to predict the residues in benthic organisms living in and on the sediments. Right now, what is done is there is some type of partitioning relationship assumed between sediments and the organism. So yes, the data could be used to directly predict residues in the benthos from the pore water. But I have not seen that done at a site yet. Now I personally have some guidance out talking about remedial gold development for sediments, and that's coming in a couple of weeks.
Okay. And one last question, and I think this is important before we go on to our next speaker. Can you just give a brief summary? We had a couple of questions regarding what exactly is a mechanistic model.
Mechanistic model is a mathematical formulation of the processes that cause that mimic what's going on in the environment. So the model mathematically describes uptake via the gills and via food, and losses from the organism via loss processes. That is a mechanistic model. It's mimicking mathematically what we think is going on in the environment.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. And we do have some additional questions. So if you'll hold on, folks, we have some great questions, and we have some time at the end that we can go through these and some questions that address all three talks, it looks like. So I'd like to move on to our final speaker of the afternoon, and that's going to be Sharon Toms, who will be talking about benchmarks for screening and some recent advances in understanding these benchmarks. Sharon, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. So this talk today, thank you for staying on as long as you have, and thank you, Lawrence and Ned, for those wonderful talks ahead of this. And hopefully this talk will raise more questions, if not answer them. We're talking about benchmarks for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons today, and that is because ORD has developed formal recommendations of sediment benchmarks for these compounds. Benchmarks are, they incorporate science and the convention of risk assessment practice based on collective knowledge and experience. And they can either be empirical or mechanistic. And just following on to what Lauren said before about mechanistic, a mechanistic benchmark will incorporate some factor having to do with the sediment property or the chemical property that is incorporated into the model. For a nonpolar organic compound, the toxicity is related to the hydrophobicity of that compound or its ability to partition off of the sediments and into the membrane lipids of the organism. And equilibrium partitioning sediment benchmarks, called ESBs, make use of the octanol water partition coefficient of the chemical and the total organic carbon content in the sediment. Whereas empirical benchmarks, and I should be on my next slide here, they are really based on a statistical evaluation of the sediment chemistry and the biological response, and they are things like the effects range low and the effects range median are based on statistics applied to matching sediment chemistry and toxicity data with no attempt to explain the toxicity based on the properties of the sediment or the chemical. They take the population of non-toxic samples, separate it from the population of toxic samples, and apply a simple statistic, or it could be a combination. And for example, the ERL is the lower 10th percentile of the population of toxic samples. The ERM is the median of the population of toxic samples. So in theory, if your sediment concentration is greater than the ERM, it should be predicted to be toxic about half of the time. So we'll go on to the next slide here. We have the function of the benchmarks, and they can either be protective or predictive. So a protective benchmark is used in the initial screening phase or tier one of an assessment. They are intended to be conservative to avoid screening out potentially toxic sediments. They are designed to protect broad range of species, typically 95% of species, and they are not intended to be used as cleanup levels. On the other hand, predictive sediment benchmarks are designed such that when exceeded, the sediment is likely to be toxic. When exceeded, a probable effects level or a probable effects concentration, that is a PEL or a PEC, is intended to identify sediments that are likely to be toxic about half the time. Some predictive benchmarks, such as the severe effects level, are looking to identify sediments that are always expected to be toxic. And then there can be other benchmarks by relaxing some of the conservative assumptions, such as protection of 95% of species, and looking at protection of a specific species. That is another way to relax some of the conservatism in a protective benchmark. However, even the predictive benchmarks are not really designed to be used as sediment cleanup goals because there are often site-specific variables that just aren't captured by these benchmarks. So it's good to have some data for your site. So now on the next slide is basically this is the goal of the talk, is to understand the benchmarks and their application. And now we have a few questions for the audience to engage you. And this is to, first of all, we want to pick the most least influential sediment variable causing an organic chemical to partition to sediments. And we have the choices listed here, and we can see that we talked about the mechanistic sediment benchmarks that consider properties of the sediment. Multiple properties of the sediment besides organic carbon content can affect the degree of adsorption of a chemical to the sediment. The stronger the chemical is bound to the sediment, the higher the concentration of the chemical can be before the sediment becomes toxic. Pick your variables. Okay, we looks to me like we have the most influence is the total organic carbon content. And let's see, the least influence, the greatest influence, okay, the least influence is sediment composition. Present finds black carbon content. A lot of people say that that has little influence, or the type of amendment. The type of amendment might be if you're trying to add something to your sediment to bind up the chemical to make it less toxic. And we don't really understand that very well yet. By answering these questions, you can help ORD focus their research. Now, I'd like to go on to the next question for our audience, and this here is picking one or more chemical property that has the most influence on the toxicity to aquatic life. So among properties of the organic chemical that explain toxicity in sediments, typically people consider the octanol water partition coefficient as a most important parameter for nonpolar organic compounds. However, there are many chemicals. Other properties can be influential. Which factors do you think are influential? A lot of people say solubility and octanol water partition coefficient and mode of toxic action. So that looks to be pretty good. Let's go on to the next question. And here we have an opportunity to pick most least environmental variable that influences sediment toxicity and partitioning. These are going to help ORD focus the research, and a lot of factors that can influence how strongly a chemical is bound to sediment. The temperature, well, whether that's important or not, you can judge, but most expressions for adsorption are developed for experimental data at 20 to 25 degrees C. Higher temperatures tend to mean less sorption. The bioaccessibility of a contaminant in sediment can be dependent on how long the contaminant has been present and exposed to the sediment, because the longer a contaminant is present, it can become trapped inside micropores, and accessibility can become more limited with increasing contact time and with the sediment matrix, because it may take time for a contaminant to contract the matrix and it might find more stronger binding sites. And also, the scientific community is reaching a consensus that measuring the concentration of chemicals directly in the sediment pore water is a way to avoid having to estimate the absorption of the chemical to the sediment. And as more data is available, we might have better models. We talked about before in Lawrence's talk about the dissolved organic carbon concentration in the pore water. And what that does is that if you have an organic compound, it's going to be binding to the dissolved organic carbon content in the pore water, and it might be less of it is freely dissolved and available to partition into your benthic organism. All right, so we'll go on with the rest of the talk here. And what I want to look at is a number of sediment benchmarks and just how well do they actually perform when screening a sediment for toxicity from PAHs. And here is just a matrix of I have eight different ones to look at, and the three of them are protective, five are predictive. They have empirical ones, mechanistic ones. Some are for broad species protection or 95% of species. Some are protective of just Hialella azteca, which we heard about as a common toxicity test species. Some look at many PAHs, some 34 PAHs, which are the parent and alkyl PAHs. Some include organic carbon, and only one of them is including the influence of black carbon. I'll go through each of them one by one. And for a protective sediment benchmark, the first one is the McDonald et al. Threshold effects concentration. This is a simple empirical benchmark that does not take into account organic carbon content of the sediment. Next one, Schwartz 1999 effects concentration. This one is based on dose response curves from number of data sets and looking at benthic community dose response, and it factors in the organic carbon content. The EPA ecological sediment benchmarks, these benchmarks protect 95% of species, but they take into account organic carbon content, PAH composition, and they require measurement of 34 parent and alkyl PAHs. They are mechanistic benchmarks. And then moving on to your predictive benchmarks, we have a very simple empirical one, the McDonald et al. 2000 probable effects concentration does not take into account organic carbon content. And we have another empirical benchmark that basically the severe effect level just is summing up your pHs and saying whether or not it's less than 100 milligrams per kilogram. And this one is intended to identify sediments that are severely toxic and heavily polluted, and toxicity is expected in the majority of sediments that exceed that 100 ppm. And now we have two equilibrium partitioning sediment benchmarks that this is a guidance document by our very own Lawrence Burkhardt. That's referenced at the bottom of the slide. And there are two benchmarks here. One of them is for a sediment concentration. This one is for an effects concentration in the water, which can be applied to pore water concentrations that you would have to measure in your sediment. So these are protective of 95% of species, and they were, but now we're going to relax that assumption and say we're protecting a single species. And it was fit to data, to the target lipid model, and the guidance document here tells you exactly how that was done. And now we have another one, final one, is the black carbon model, and this is explained by the paper referenced by McGrath et al. 2019, and we are going to estimate the concentration of PAHs in the sediment pore water from the composition of the black carbon and total organic carbon in the sediment, and you're going to compare the predicted pore water concentrations to the final chronic value as reported in the EPA 2003 PAH guidance document. Okay, we'll see. This is how they are compared. We have the number of false positives, which is the toxicity was expected but was not observed. The false negatives, toxicity was not expected but was observed. The percent correct predictions, which is predictions of both toxic and non-toxic sediments. The data set was on manufactured gas plants, aluminum smelters, and urban sites contaminated with PAHs from ARP et al. 2011. There were 34 EPA PAHs measured. Organic carbon and black carbon were measured, and pore water was measured for 34 PAHs, as well as the data, they were tested for toxicity to Hialeah, and then there was another organism too. So this is how the performance of the PAH benchmarks, and here, Jean, I'd like to request my arrow, please. So first thing to notice is that the rate of false negatives was less than 10% for all of the models here. We have, these are the protective models, so we have the three models here being compared, and that a false negative can occur when toxicity is caused by a factor other than PAH concentration. So a low rate of false negatives means that this was a good data set for studying the effects of PAHs versus other stressors. Now we'll look at the rate of false positives, which was around 75% for all the protective benchmarks. So all the protective benchmarks provide a very conservative screening level evaluation. The overall efficiency was only about 35%, and the improvement in the overall efficiency of going from 30% to 35% was achieved by the Swartz 1999 TEC by incorporation of the total organic carbon content. And the EPA 2003 equilibrium sediment benchmark had a lower false negative rate than the other models, and that was on account of assigning lesser toxicity to high molecular weight PAHs in the mixture. Overall, factoring in the sediment total organic carbon content and accounting for lesser toxicity of PAH mixtures containing high molecular weight PAHs only slightly improved the screening outcomes over the empirical models. So what this means is that because we have mechanistic sediment benchmarks and empirical sediment benchmarks compared, and the mechanistic sediment benchmarks did not perform very much better than the empirical benchmarks, it means that there are factors other than the ones that are incorporated in the model, which were the octanol water partition coefficient and the total organic carbon content. There are other factors that control the toxicity of the sediments that were not incorporated into the models, and those are the ones, some of the factors that you were voting on today. So now we'll go on to the next slide, is the performance of the predictive sediment benchmarks. So we'll look at first the McDonald et al. PEC, and this benchmark here is an empirical benchmark. And the previous slide, we looked at that the overall efficiency, was about 30%, and now I guess it went up to 55%. And the false positive rate was just under 70% for the McDonald et al., and it had gone from, say, I think it was 75 to 70%. And so what we were expecting for this probable effect concentration is it was supposed to be predicting sediments are toxic about half the time, but actually what happened in this test with this particular data set from ARPA-DAL 2011 was that the samples predicted to be toxic by the PEC, only 31% were actually toxic. So the overall efficiency, or the number of correct predictions of either toxic or non-toxic sediments, increased from roughly 35% to roughly 70% when going from the protective benchmark to a predictive benchmark. And the rate of false negatives remained below 10%, except for the last model, which is the one that incorporated the black carbon. The black carbon model reduced the false positive rate, error rate, down to very low, way less than 10%. However, the false negative rate increased above 10% because in some cases, the black carbon model overestimated the degree of absorption of PAHs onto the sediment. So the black carbon model maybe needs a little work, or it's not completely, it didn't perform as well as we thought it would. And one other thing to look at is that the severe effect level, this that was very simple, empirical, it really did a pretty good job even compared to some of these mechanistic models, and it reduced the false positive error rate from 75% to 55%. However, the severe effect level missed some of the toxic samples compared to the most successful model. And the biggest improvement, however, with these models was the benchmark that incorporated measurements of PAHs in sediment pore water. So that was this one with the pore water is the red one. So that one actually did the best, that it had the highest overall efficiency, and it had low false positives, still had low false negatives. And the improvement was largely on account of the pore water measurements and eliminating the organic carbon partitioning assumption. So we'll go on to the take-home message here is on account of the fact that sediments are composed of complex mixtures of contaminants, even if you have a study like this, ARPA-DAL 2011, and you look at the pore water and mechanistic benchmarks, you still, what I've concluded is that if you wanted to study this and go further with this and try to improve your mechanistic benchmarks, that you probably wouldn't do a whole lot better by adjusting the organic carbon partitioning model or getting a better log KOW or looking at improvements to the model by different regressions for predicting the toxicity of the compound, because it appears that site-specific or unknown factors are still important here and that you may still require measurements at your site to define your cleanup goals rather than using the simplistic screening. The screening level benchmarks are not to be used as cleanup levels, and direct measurements of pore water with the membrane devices are really important, or else even prediction of pore water concentrations from black carbon and two carbon models maybe is another option, but still that model didn't work as well as we would have hoped for all of the sediment sites. But really we want to be able to measure the pore water concentrations. Another way to improve the way the models work would be you don't have to really measure all 34 PAHs, that you can use a multiplier for alkyl PAHs, and that is explained in the guidance document. And overall, that if you use this multiplier, you can do just as well with the model that we described about the Hialalla Azteca sediment benchmark and do it for fewer PAHs, such as 16 PAHs, and use the multiplier to adjust your benchmark. So now I open it up for questions. The last slide here is just the papers that are discussed.
Well, thanks, Sharon. One thing before we get to the questions, and we have several of them, the work that you present here, is there a paper that summarizes this work that you've done, Sharon?
Well, I haven't written a paper about it, but this a lot of this work is in this paper by McGrath et al. If you wanted to just see the conservative benchmarks and how they compare. So what I did for this talk is, for many of these, it was really easy to take the data set and reproduce or to look at slightly different combinations of benchmarks than were looked at in this paper. And the black carbon results come directly from that paper by McGrath et al. But they overall know that exactly from this talk, there's no paper.
Okay, that's helpful. And we'll leave that slide up with the papers that folks can reference. Can you give us just a quick definition, the difference between total organic carbon and black carbon?
Well, it appears that black carbon is a subset of total organic carbon. That total organic carbon includes natural organic carbon and black carbon, which is more of a soot carbon, and there's a particular measurement that is made for the black carbon.
Okay, thanks. And we have a question here regarding how toxicity was identified in these studies. Was it based on just Hylella survival, or growth, or biomass, or some other organism growth or biomass? Or was there some other toxicity test?
This was all based on the Hylella survival. And all of this work was based on that. But the data set included another, I guess that was for the freshwater sediments, but for the saltwater sediments, there was another organism. I believe it was the Leptochirus that was used. So that there was another set of data that could be evaluated by the same procedure that's from the same author, but this just looked at the Hylella data set.
Okay. And a couple of times you mentioned the value of direct measurement of pore water. Do you have a recommendation or an approach for measuring pore water? I know in our first session we heard a little bit about passive samplers, and we'll hear more about that in session four, or direct measurement. Do you have any comments on the type of measurement method for pore water?
I would recommend the passive sampling devices, and that there's a guidance document that EPA has put out on measuring the pore water concentrations using the passive devices. So I would just go with find someone who has expertise in that area.
Okay. All right, that's great. I think we're going to have a couple of talks on that in our session four, and there is some great guidance also available. Okay. Well, thank you. That's all the questions we had specific to your talk. So now I'd like to open up our discussion to some of the previous talks and try to go through those questions. And then we have a couple of general topics that we'd like to address. So for the Bolsa Chica PAH example, how long was that toxicity test done for? Ned, could you give us some more info on that?
I will have to go back and look that up, but it was standard. I think it was a 24-hour test, but I'll have to go back and look. We did use the standard protocols. Let me call that up. But so go on.
Okay, sure. So, Lauren, we had a question for Lawrence regarding your comment about PFAS. Could you give us your experience with looking at these PFAS materials and also any experience you have with activated carbon treatment. One of our attendees is interested in finding out more about your comment related to PFAS.
Sure. PFAS are, in general, tend to be polar organic chemicals. That means they're ionized when they're in the water column. And that makes them have very different behavior than PCBs, dioxins, DDTs, those kinds of things. In terms of bioaccumulation, they are there are active transport processes that these chemicals are handled via. They're taken up and then excreted via renal processes. The I'm not sure the question was. Can you repeat the question? Did I lose you?
Oh, sure. Here I am. I'm sorry.
The question again was, like we know, I mean, like for example, PFOS, the 8-carbon fully sulfonated acid, you know, it has a BAF of, you know, something like 3.3 log scale. So it is taken up. Other things that are longer chains tend to have a little bit higher BAS, and things that are shorter tend to have a little lower BAS. We do know those kinds of things.
Okay, so it sounds like it's just not appropriate that these chemicals be used or the models be used for these PFAS chemicals.
That is correct.
Because of their, okay.
They do not behave. All the models are developed for chemicals that are taken up and excreted by the organisms via passive diffusion. These chemicals, the fluorinated materials, are essentially there's active transport mechanisms that are controlling the residues and uptake and elimination. And that is why the models that we use for PCBs and dioxins and furans and DDTs and other things like that are not appropriate. Now, the comment about activated carbon, I don't have any direct knowledge on that. I know that I've heard people say that in order to really kind of tie these things up, you need to use some type of ion exchange resin. And you think about it, if you have something that's ionized, like PFAS is in the natural environment, you have to have something that will interact with that active charge site. And so I know that at the last Patel conference, there was a presentation where they were using some type of active some type of ion exchange material. I suspect carbon would pick up some of these chemicals, but I don't know how much, and I don't know how well. I'd have to do some looking.
So that sounds like it's a potential area for review, is understanding more about these PFAS compounds and their interaction with the sediment and the water and benthos.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the literature right now, there's piles of people doing all kinds of measurements right now trying to figure this stuff out. And what makes it really confusing and very difficult, if you look at the OECD global list of chemicals, there's 4,730 chemicals on that list. It's not a simple one or two chemicals. And that's what really makes it difficult. And the other thing, when I say difficult, is like, well, we have the straight chain carboxylic acid, sulfonic acids. Well, then, because those are somewhat bioaccumulative, manufacturers said, okay, let's not make it fully fluorinated, but let's make it partially fluorinated. So you have those chemicals. Well, then they say, well, what if we put a little ether linkage in there somewhere in that carbon chain? That changes the behavior. That changes the structure. And it just spirals out like that. So and it turns out a lot of these chemicals that are out there can be biotransformed by us and fish and many organisms. They'll be biotransformed back down to the carboxylic acid because that's the natural degradation route. For example, alcohols. There's a lot of PFAS alcohols out there, and the alcohol functionality will be changed into a carboxylic acid functionality.
Okay. Now, Lawrence, we had a couple of really introductory type questions that folks had some real basic questions about. So can you just briefly describe what BSAF and BAF stand for and what the difference is between the two?
Sure. Let me go back. Excuse me. Right here. Yeah. Went too far. Come on.
There you go.
BSAF stands for biota sediment accumulation factor. I'll say that again. Biota sediment accumulation factor. And it is the ratio of concentration in the fish on a lipid basis divided by the concentration in the sediment on an organic carbon basis. A BAF is a bioaccumulation factor, and that is simply a ratio of concentration in the fish on a lipid basis divided by the concentration in the water on a freely dissolved basis. A BAF is measured in the field. A BSAF is measured in the field, but if you do a sediment test in the laboratory with umbriculus, for example, is a standard test for sediments, you can measure a BSAF in the laboratory for that particular test. If you go in and do a water exposure in the laboratory with a chemical, that is a bioconcentration factor, which is the same ratio, concentration in the fish by, on a lipid basis divided by the concentration in the water. But that, in the, when done in the laboratory, that is a bioconcentration factor.
So BCF and BAF are very similar then?
Yes, they have this, they are a ratio of concentration in fish to concentration in water. Bioconcentration factor is measured in the laboratory using standard protocols. A BAF is something that is measured in the field. In the field.
The difference
between the two is, in a bioconcentration factor measurement done in the laboratory, it's exposure via the water only. A BAF, which is measured in the field, represents all exposure routes, uptake from water, uptake from food. And if the organism is living on the sediments, maybe uptake through the skin, or maybe even digest uptake of the sediments. So that is the difference between a BCF and a BAF.
Okay. So we did have another question related to accumulation in fish. Does the fish accumulate more from the water or from its food sources?
Well, that depends partly on the type of chemical. For a chemical with an octanol water partition coefficient of, let's say, less than a log of 5, water exposure is the dominant route. That's because it can pick it up and it can depurate the chemical extremely fast via its gills. When you get above a KOW of 5, then food can become important. and it can become the dominant route. Now, what's tricky is, let's say you're at a Superfund site and your upstream concentration of PCBs, for example, coming into the site in the water column is 10 parts per billion, let's just say. That amount of chemical coming in from background sources could overwhelm what you're actually getting up through the sediments via the food web. And so it's kind of a ratio thing, depending on how much you have in the water versus how much you have coming up via the benthic food web. And so every site will be a little different.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lawrence. I'd like to jump back to Ned's talk a little bit. Ned, you generated a little bit of discussion here, a little bit of interest in the McClellan case. There's some interesting results that you presented. And one of our participants was asking about the term you used. You mentioned the toxic mode of action did not correlate. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. And also, in the meantime, I went back and discovered that the amphipod bioassays we used at Dulce Chica were 10-day bioassays. So that's the answer to the previous question. With the McClellan data that I discussed, to clarify, what I was saying was that when we looked at the concentration of our contaminants in the stream sediments at McClellan compared to our toxicity results, first of all, there was no correlation between any single contaminant and, or the concentrations of any single contaminant and the observed toxicity in the different samples. So then we expanded our evaluation to look at groups of contaminants that had the same toxic mode of action. So for instance, not just looking at individual metals, but looking at metals as a whole that we could say exerted toxicity in a similar, that we would predict would exert toxicity in a similar fashion. So the heavy metals, manganese and iron and cadmium and zinc, in terms of their, and those, and the other heavy metals, we would expect the toxicity from those metals would all come about by the same mode of action in the amphipods. And so instead of looking at those metals individually, we summed the metals and saw if there was a correlation between total metals and the observed toxicity. We did the same thing with chlorinated pesticides of course, looking at all of the PCBs. So it was just an effort to make sure we weren't missing any successful correlation between contaminants and toxicity when I referred to looking at the toxic mode of action. And we saw none. We saw no correlation. Does that?
Okay. I think that helps a lot. But, you know, that brings me back to a question that relates to the overall result here at McClellan. Boy, you saw some really variable results here. What do you draw as a conclusion? What do you think caused this incredible difference in the toxicity result at McClellan? Do you have any theories?
It was very frustrating. I'll just start out by saying that. It was extremely frustrating. Unfortunately, we really were never able to come up with a good explanation. My theory was that we were seeing, my best theory, was that we were seeing toxicity at different locations from different of the contaminants. I don't think that, based on my knowledge of the site, I don't think that there was any, there were underlying factors that caused toxicity for other reasons, like temperature change or any changes in the ionics, you know, in total dissolved solids in the streams based on inputs from surface drains, stormwater drains, for instance. So I could not find any other factors in terms of water quality, either physical or chemical water quality, that gave me any confidence that they were causing these varieties or these various levels of toxicity. So my best theory was that just simply at different locations around the streams, different contaminants of the contaminants that we measured were causing the toxicity that we observed. But I'll say quite frankly, I argued that point with EPA headquarters for several weeks, and was always told that if I could not identify a specific concentration gradient for a specific contaminant, that the toxicity bioassays could not be used to set cleanup goals. So again, so in summary, my best guess is that I was seeing toxicity from the contaminants, and it was just at different locations, different contaminants were responsible for that toxicity, but I could not nail it down on a concentration gradient.
Okay, interesting. So I have a question for all three speakers. We got a few questions that relate to the different types of analyses that can be done to support both the modeling and tox testing. And it has to do with looking for total concentrations versus bioavailable concentrations in the sediment, or the use of interstitial water measurements for within the sediment. What is the preferred method and data set for analysis of toxicity as well as for modeling?
I'll just jump in real quick. Or go ahead, Lauren.
Sure. For toxicity, I would say measuring what's in the pore water.
Okay.
That
Ned?
Would give you the best measure of what's available to the organism of interest.
And Ned here, I would agree with that. I think one of the problems that we faced at McClellan, that data set is from a number of years ago, and it was before I felt that there was a good way to measure pore water concentrations. Now I would say you should use some sort of passive sampler to get your pore water concentrations. The old methods for getting pore water concentrations tended to introduce a lot of confounding factors that then complicated your interpretation of the data.
I would agree.
Okay, Sharon. Thanks. So then, is pore water measured in the field and then the sediment sent to the tox lab, or how does that work?
Some of the tox labs will actually put the passive sampler into the toxicity test chamber and measure it at the same time as the toxicity.
Okay. Interesting.
There are devices that have been developed that you can buy commercially now that you go out and just stick them in the sediments. in the field. And they have been used and are becoming more routinely used now at sites. But clearly, if you want to do a laboratory test, as Sharon's suggesting, measuring it in the laboratory and the test, that would give you the best comparison between what those organisms in the tests are actually seeing.
Okay. Now, for bioaccumulation assessments, how often is the octanol water partitioning coefficient used? Is that commonly used?
It is, for any food web modeling, it is the key parameter that drives accumulation, period. It is the key parameter.
Okay.
Now, when you talk about TSCA, not part of Superfund, TSCA and that realm, the KOW is used as an initial screen to say, is this chemical of concern from a bioaccumulation standpoint? There are defined cutoffs for that. And depending on where you are, if you are in Europe, there are different sets of guidelines than what's in the U.S. and different than from what's in Canada, different from what's in Japan, and they're all kind of barking around the area, same area though. But the KOW or nonpolar organics is the dominant parameter that we use to assess behavior uptake.
Okay. In several of the talks we heard about PCBs, we had several questions come in about PCBs. One is that our thought is that we think of PCBs as being hydrophobic. So why is information on water concentration so important for PCBs? And are they truly hydrophobic in the sense of these models and toxicity assessments that we're talking about today?
I think it's important to measure the concentration in the surface water for PCBs. Well, we have a surface water nationally recommended water quality criteria for protection of aquatic life of 0.014 micrograms per liter, and also because it's the concentration of PCBs that's freely dissolved in the water column that is going to be accumulating into your fish, and fish are going to be your primary route of exposure in your risk assessment. And so if you have the PCBs in the surface water, that we know for sure that those are going to be uptake into the fish or any other aquatic organisms, and that if you have it above the surface water standard, you probably have a source of PCBs present. It could be in the sediment, or it could really just be that it's coming from upstream and it's washing downstream into that area.
Although I think it's important to differentiate between water column feeding fish and bottom feeding fish, and I was going to follow up with Lawrence on this, actually, that for fish that are essentially directly feeding on the sediments or feeding on critters that are living in the sediments, if you were going to model that, you would want the poor water concentration of the sediments, but it was unclear to me that you would need the water column concentration, but something being unclear to me doesn't mean that, simply means that. It doesn't mean that I disagree. I'm just uneducated.
Well, what you say is true. If you have a carp, for example, that's eating a bunch of benthic invertebrates and sucking a lot of sediment through its digestive tract, it's going to take up a lot more chemical than a pelagic fish that's feeding on the water column from that particular sediment. But the loss routes via the gills are, because a fish respires liters of water per day across the gills, it can push a lot of chemical out the gills, depurate. And so knowing something about what the gradient is between what the differential is, when I see differential, is what's the concentration in the water column, and how hard does it have to push in order to eliminate chemical out the gills? When I say push chemical, I'm talking chemical potential now.
Thanks. That makes a lot more sense to me now.
Okay. Well, hopefully that answered the participant's question there. So we got an interesting question in, and this is something that we see at a number of sites, and it's the understanding and distinguishing between using the sediment screening criteria and soil screening criteria, especially when we're dealing with ephemeral streams. So I was wondering if each of you could make some comment on the methods to distinguish between these two media and when it's appropriate to use one set of benchmarks or modeling approaches versus another, specifically related to these ephemeral streams, which tend to be a real challenge to evaluate.
Well, I'll take a first stab at that since I'm from the Pacific Southwest and I have a lot of sites with ephemeral streams, which, as I noticed in the questions that people were putting in at the back, way back at the beginning, that some of us are aware that it's very difficult to evaluate ephemeral streams. And the specific question is very important. The simple answer is, for an ephemeral stream, is that I would use both, if I could, I would use both a sediment benchmark and a soil benchmark and evaluate them for the different times of the year or when the stream either had water or didn't, or had surface water or didn't. But it is inappropriate in many instances to use a soil benchmark to evaluate sediments. So if some media is truly sediment all or almost all of the time, then it's probably not appropriate to compare to a soil benchmark. So again, my simple answer is do both, but just be very aware what's actually happening, how that compares to what's actually happening in your habitat.
Lawrence, do you have a comment on that?
I'm struggling with a good comment. if you're worried about fish, the fish won't be there when it's dry. And so it's a moot question, I think. If you start thinking about inverts, that becomes kind of a different question, and I'm not really sure I know the answer to that either.
Well, that sounds like an interesting challenge in risk assessment, something that might be an appropriate research topic to tackle, or to clarify anyways.
So this is Sharon Toms. And normally we would classify it as a sediment if it was wet for more than 6 months out of the year, or if when the sediment sample, when the sample was collected, if there was overlying water, we might call it a sediment. And if there wasn't overlying water, we might call it a soil. And we might look at the assessment endpoint and see whether there was a critical time of the year that was either the breeding season or something we're interested in, and then whether or not it was inundated at that time of year could give us an answer. Or if it was a purely mechanistic sediment benchmark for an organic compound, then you wouldn't really expect that it would be very different for a soil or a sediment, because the organic carbon partitioning model is pretty much the same between the soil and sediment, and you only have the difference of the air as a compartment for partitioning. If it's a soil, it's not completely saturated, and for most chemicals, the amount that is actually present in the the pore space or the air is very small. But I would say if it's an organic compound, it may not really make a lot of difference which one you use, but if it's a metal or something, then it probably you should never use the soil benchmark and the sediment benchmark interchangeably.
Okay. Thank you, Sharon. So we had a question come in. It seems to be kind of site-specific, and I'd like to pose it, and I'll read it verbatim just to make sure we get the context correctly. Source identification appears to be the most important factor to determine risk. We have sediment sites that are limited in dredging because of ecological chemicals above the SEF. The problem is that some of these sites also have other permitted sources, such as NPDES discharges, that don't account for the chemicals list that we have to characterize in sediments. What do you think the solution to this issue should be?
Trying to wrap my head around that one. What it sounds like is the questioner is referring to the analytical requirements that are simply part of a dredging program for evaluating disposal options for dredged material, which are not necessarily the same that you would evaluate for a site as a hazardous waste site. But the source of the contaminants plays in there in terms of who's going to pay for the disposal, I guess, and how the material has to be treated, whether it actually has to be treated as a hazardous waste. I don't know that I have a good answer other than that you can't be limited by just looking at your dredge material disposal requirements. You have to evaluate for all contaminants, regardless of what source they come from. I'm going to stop there for now until I can come up with a better answer.
It almost sounds like there's a mismatch between the analytical list for sediments versus the analytical list for the data that's available for the NPDES discharge. So it sounds like there might be a need for better characterization of both surface water as well as sediment. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah.
I would, yeah, I think so.
But that costs money. somebody's going to have to pay for that better characterization, and if it's not a requirement in the statute or regulations, then there's just going to be an endless argument as to who's going to pay for it.
I was going to say it's probably under different regulatory authority in. Clearly, Superfund has certain well-defined limits and bounds versus other regulatory statutes and programs.
Yeah.
Ideally, whatever site you're looking at is being addressed by some larger monitoring body. Most of the major estuaries and many rivers in the U.S. have some site-specific monitoring body. Here in the San Francisco Bay, we have the regional monitoring program that goes out and samples just for a lot of things and is funded by dischargers. But the work that they do is not limited specifically to, say, meeting NPDES permits. So if that's the situation, then I think you get the data you need. If you don't have some larger umbrella monitoring group it's going to be a difficult argument to make.
Okay. All right. And then we did have another question concerning endpoints. Let me see if I can find that question. There was a question as to whether or not it's appropriate to use NOELs and LOELs. What about identifying NOAELs and LOAELs, even if they're not correlations? Is that still of value?
I think it is. Just to make sure everybody on the call understands that those stand for no observed effects and as opposed to the lowest observed effect or the concentration associated with either no observed effect or the lowest observed effect. If you can get that from your data, but you don't, without having to also having good enough data to establish a true concentration gradient, that certainly has value. And I would argue that you should be able to make decisions based on that. But it's not.
I mean, clearly from a toxicological standpoint, what you want is a clear dose response with some well-defined endpoint, whether it's an LC50 or an LC10 or LC90 or whatever the endpoint is. NOELs and LOELs get you somewhere, but they're not as nice and definitive as a true, real good dose response curve. And that kind of echoes what Ned was kind of following up with.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Lawrence, we have about a minute or two. I was just wondering if we could go to your purple fish. We only have a couple of minutes.
Sure, we can go to the purple fish. What I was hoping here is just to see what people would think, and I can kind of talk ad nauseum here about this particular diagram. And what
we only have a couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, if you add activated carbon to the sediment, and let's say your problem is PCBs, that will tie up the PCBs. So all the organisms here, the plants, these three different species here, oligochaetes and I can't remember what these two things are. I can't read them. They will take up less chemical because the chemical is less available. So that will result in less chemical, depending on the diet of this forage fish, how much of this is eating. It will lower the residue in this fish. The other thing that by adding activated carbon to the sediments, you will make the flux from the sediment to the water column, if it is occurring, much less because you've tied the chemical up. That should result in the residue in the fish going down. Now, if the diet of the fish essentially, of this forage fish here, is essentially all from the pink arrow here, zooplankton and phytoplankton, and none from these green arrows here, then the residue in the fish will probably not go down as much because what will be affected by the residue here is this flux over here. This will be reduced. And so what are processes that are impacted? The flux, the bioavailability of the chemical to the organisms on the sediment, and that will ultimately affect the residue here and then affect the residue on this fish. That's kind of what we expect, and from the limited number of sites that we've had demos done, it seems to work.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, Thank you for that great explanation. I think that explains a lot about the application of activated carbon, which we'll see in some of our upcoming talks. So please stay tuned. So I'd like to thank our speakers, Sharon, Lawrence, and Ned, and turn it back over to Jean for some closing remarks.
All right, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. I'm going to remind everybody that the series is carrying on. So in about 2 weeks, we'll be back on the line with session number 3 on remediation technologies. And then the fourth and final session will take place later in November, where we'll talk about long-term monitoring. If you haven't yet already signed up for those sessions, I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org and look at our live training calendar to sign up for these sessions. We do have information at cluin.org about contaminated sediment sites. I encourage you to also take a look at our sediments issue area to learn more about the resources we've posted there. And to be sure that you're aware when free online seminars like this are available, please sign up for our monthly newsletter at, called Tech Direct, which actually goes out on the first of each month. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, they are already posted on the seminar homepage. That's the same homepage that you would have used when you checked in at the start of today's session. We've also got contact information for our presenters and organizers available there, should you need to reach out to one of them later on. I will ask each of you, though, to take a moment and fill out our online feedback form for today's session, where you'll be able to give your input on how we delivered our talk, as well as the content that was covered, and some of the changes that we've made to respond to feedback from the session, the first one that we started the series with. But I also want to remind you that there will be additional questions in there, specifically allowing you to share your input on research needs or questions that EPA's Office of Research and Development address when it comes to contaminated sediment sites. So please be sure to share your thoughts on that form. One of the most common questions I get as a moderator is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we don't issue those particular type of credit hours, we do have information on the seminar homepage and a certificate that you can get after you fill out that feedback form. Many times people are able to take information from the session along with that certificate as documentation to get credit with whatever their accrediting institution was as part of their professional training hours. So remember, when you're filling out that feedback form, that's the only way you'll get one. You have to complete the feedback form and make sure you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the whole session. If you do that, as soon as you fill out the feedback form, you will immediately have access to a certificate that looks like this, which you can either save or print out for your own records. If you participated as a group, each person can actually fill out that feedback form to get their own certificate, regardless if they registered on their own or not. So if you happen to be the one that registered, please be sure to share the link to the feedback form with others who joined you in your room so that they can get their own certificate. You'll find the link to that feedback form in the Q&A window, as well as on the middle right under related URLs. For those specifically looking for a type of credit hours called CLPs, almost every piece of information you would need to submit a points request for this session is available on the seminar homepage. So you'll find the event name, the description, the type it was a training, classroom or online, the date it was hosted, as well as the number of points that you could request for the session. As noted, we recommend that you include your certificate along with your registration email if you have one, and then the course materials, again, is documentation that you participated in the session today. Today's session was recorded, and we'll have the archive up in about 1 week. We already have session 1 in the series available. You'll find it on the middle right under related URLs. As soon as session number 2 has been archived and is available, you'll get an email, and I encourage you to share that with others who will find this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones who replayed the entire session, you can still follow those links to the seminar feedback form, fill it out based off of your replay, and get a participation certificate. So with that, I want to echo everyone's thanks to our organizers and speakers who joined us, as well as the 350 people from actually multiple countries who joined us for today's live broadcast. We'll go ahead and formally